morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is the time for hearing en banc in the case of United States of America v. Novak. We understand counsel are all present and that Judge Pragerson is with us by video. And I see him there. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, counsel for the appellant may proceed.
May it please the Court, good morning. My name is Brent Whittlesey, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the government in this case. The issue that's presented to the Court in this case is whether Congress has determined that a criminal restitution judgment may be satisfied from assets that are contained in a criminal defendant's ERISA-qualified pension plan. There are three reasons why this Court should conclude that Congress intended that ERISA-qualified pension plans be subject to the enforcement of a criminal restitution judgment. I will list those three reasons and then explain each of them in greater detail. First, in Section 3613A of the Criminal Code, Congress stated that the list of exemptions that applies to the enforcement of a federal criminal judgment is applicable notwithstanding any other provision of the Social Security Act or of any other federal law. Second, in Section 3613C, Congress instructed that the list of criminal judgments for restitution should be enforced in the same fashion as federal tax judgments. And we know that federal tax obligations may be satisfied from ERISA-qualified pension plan assets.
Is this a lien?
Pardon me?
Is there a lien here?
There is a lien, Your Honor, yes. And that's also created by Section 3613C. Third, Your Honors, in Section 3613C, Congress listed certain kinds of pensions that are exempt from execution to satisfy a federal criminal debt. Congress could have included ERISA-qualified pension plan assets in that list of exempt property, but chose not to do so. Going back then to the first reason that I mentioned.
If those three reasons tell us what Congress's intent was, why did Congress pass the law in 1997 saying that, amending ERISA to say that it's the conviction for a crime involving the plan that provides an exception? Doesn't that say that Congress thought that only those convictions or only those crimes? The restitution resulting from those crimes was excluded
in
other restitution?
In Section 1056d4, Your Honor, Congress did make an exception from the ERISA anti-alienation provisions for criminal judgments that are pertain to crimes committed against the plan. And that was in response to the Supreme Court's decision in Guidry. We believe, Your Honor, that that does not implicate Section 3613A, because that provision, Section D4, applies to any criminal judgment. It could be entered in state court as a result of a crime against the plan, as well as a federal criminal judgment. So Congress has done something different in Section 3613A.
You mean they sure that only court judgments led to restitution? The only ones that could be enforced are ones involving the crime. Involving the plan, that they want federal restitution to come from all crimes.
I think, Your Honor, Section D4 applies to either a state or a federal criminal restitution judgment for a crime committed against a plan. Section 3613A applies to any federal criminal restitution judgment for.
Your explanation is that Congress, we're looking under your theory that Congress's intent, that they intended victims of federal crimes all to be able to get restitution, the victims of the same crimes in state courts not to get restitution,
well,
unless it was a crime against the plan?
No, Your Honor. I don't mean that. I mean that the D4 exemption from the anti-alienation provisions of ERISA would apply regardless of whether a criminal restitution judgment was entered in the state court or in the federal court. That's all I need to say.
Henry said that vis-a-vis ERISA, that if Congress wanted to carve out a specific exception, they should do it in unmistakable language. And this was their response. Their response was to allow liens, et cetera, against ERISA criminal violations. So that suggests that they wanted to add others, they could have?
Your Honor, they did say in Guidry, of course, that there are no equitable exemption, equitable exceptions to the anti-alienation provisions of ERISA. And we believe that Section 3613A is a statutory exception to the anti-alienation provisions of ERISA of the kind that the Supreme Court referred to in Guidry.
I thought I heard you argue that the inclusion of ERISA crimes was in response to Guidry.
In the statute that Judge Reinhart mentioned, which was Section D4 of Section 1056.
Well, responding to a Supreme Court decision that says if you want to create an exception to ERISA's anti-alienation provisions, you have to do it explicitly. And when they do it explicitly, they only carve out ERISA crimes. Is that right?
Your Honor, we believe that...
Have I stated anything wrong?
No, sir.
Nothing inaccurate in what I just stated?
Sir, we believe that Section 3613A is another exception to the anti-alienation provisions of ERISA for the three reasons that I mentioned at the outset. For example, in Section 3613A, the Congress made certain kinds of pension benefits exempt from execution to satisfy criminal restitution judgments, and those are service-connected disability pensions for military veterans.
Why do you suppose Senator McCain offered the amendment?
Counsel, didn't Congress just expressly consider and then reject an amendment to the statute that would have created an exemption to ERISA's anti-alienation provisions for restitution orders?
I'm not aware of that, Your Honor.
Your argument with respect to 3613A relies in large part on what weight we give to the term notwithstanding.
Yes, Your Honor. And the language that's included in that provision of Section 3613A is very similar to the language that's included in the Internal Revenue Code, which was construed by this Court in the McIntyre case.
I guess the difficulty I have is if you take the word not – first, I think we all in agreement as to what the Supreme Court said, that we need some kind of clear intent. And then our charge, of course, is to figure out whether this falls in that category or not. My concern is that when we look at Ninth Circuit and other cases that use the word notwithstanding, the courts rarely say that that satisfies a burden of clear intent. It's either not dispositive or it's only enforced if there's no other reasonable construction of the statute. So what I'm interested in is, in light of that line of cases in the Ninth Circuit, what support you have that would give the word notwithstanding the elevated presence of something in that order of clear intent?
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, in Title 26, Section 6334, sub C, that's the Internal Revenue Code, Congress said, notwithstanding any other law of the United States, including Section 207 of the Social Security Act, no other rights or property shall be exempt. And that language is quite similar to the language in Section 3613A that we rely on, which says, notwithstanding any other federal law, including Section 207 of the Social Security Act.
It's not quite as strong, would you say that? It's not quite as definitive.
Well, I don't see any appreciable difference between...
One directly addresses the question of whether there are any other exceptions and the other one doesn't.
That's true. One is in the affirmative and the other is in the negative.
When was that?
Are you familiar with Lockhart versus Mary States? It's a very recent Supreme Court decision.
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
And there it says, it kind of grounds on the use of notwithstanding any other provision of statute as a basis for finding a specific exemption there the higher educational technical amendments sweepingly eliminated limitations to certain language going after Social Security benefits in our case to pay, to offset against it once.
Right.
And they rejected the notwithstanding any other provision of statute language, and that found that there could be such an offset because the higher because the, in 1996, another congressional enactment specifically said, I'll pay, you know, reference the Social Security Act, and said that that anti-alienage provision there would not apply. It's only because of a specific subsequent inaction, not because of a prior statute that said notwithstanding any other law.
Judge Wardlaw, as we read Lockhart,
excuse me, could I just interrupt for just a moment? Judge Pragerson, your rustling papers is too close to the microphone, and it's can be heard all over the courtroom. You could move the microphone away from the papers, and the papers away from the thank
you. All right, I'll have my technician do that.
Judge Wardlaw, as we read Lockhart, there are two kinds of actions that Congress needs to take to amend statutes and make it clear that an exception applies. There are certain statutes, such as Section 207 of the Social Security Act, that have a so-called express reference provision in the statutes. And they say, in so many words, this statute can't be amended except by another one that makes express reference to it. So Congress, when they mean to amend Section 207, has to say, we mean to amend Section 207. Other statutes that don't have an express reference provision, as we read Lockhart, can be amended by a subsequent statute that says, notwithstanding any other federal law.
Has the Supreme Court spoken directly to that point other than in Lockhart, you know, the point that the fact of an express requirement
no,
written into the statute?
I don't know that the Supreme Court has, Your Honor, but this Court has in McIntyre.
Essentially, what you're saying is that the Guidry clear intent requirement is not an express requirement. It's not different from the 207 express statement requirement.
Correct, Your Honor.
Which is, and the difference is the difference between an intent expressed sort of in ordinary statutory intent terms and one that expressly addresses the question.
Yes, that's true, Your Honor.
Let me ask you, what was the, on what date was the notwithstanding language passed as part of the Internal Revenue Code? Well, if you don't know the precise date, what I'm trying to figure out is, was it passed prior to the adoption of ERISA?
After the adoption of ERISA, I believe, Your Honor.
I think it was before.
Was it? Okay.
And ERISA is quite clear that it does not intend to interfere with the operation of pre-existing law. So that I think the notwithstanding clause in the Internal Revenue Code occupies a very different position from the notwithstanding clause later on after Guidry, because at that point the notwithstanding has to get around ERISA and has to get around Guidry, whereas we're reading the notwithstanding clause in the Internal Revenue Code in light of ERISA's statement that we're not interfering with existing law.
Yes, that may be so, Your Honor, but I would also note that in the Shanbaum case, which is cited in our brief, the Fifth Circuit had determined that the notwithstanding clause in the Internal Revenue Code meant to supersede ERISA. And after the decision by the Fifth Circuit in the Shanbaum case, Congress amended Section 3613A to include the language that I've discussed, which is notwithstanding any other federal law.
Also, the savings clause in ERISA is not temporal, is it? In other words, I don't understand it to mean that it's only saving what was there before. It's saving a federal saving federal statutes in general.
Yes, and subsequently enacted federal statutes. Yes.
If the notwithstanding were determined to not be definitive, you were in some sort of equipoise. What about 3613C? I would appreciate your interpretation of how you view this restitution judgment becoming a lien and then being treated like a tax lien.
Well, Your Honor, in the Wright against Riften case, this Court has noted that ERISA benefits are not subject to the anti-alienation provision as soon as they're paid to the beneficiary. So we have a lien. The government has a lien for the benefit of victims of crime on the assets at the time that they're in the plan. And under the Riveton case, we know that the government can execute on those benefits as soon as they're paid out. And so really the only thing we're talking about in this case is a timing issue of whether victims have to wait in order to obtain the value of that asset. Do they have to wait until an ERISA plan beneficiary becomes entitled to receive the assets and does, in fact, receive the assets?
Well, one thing that confuses me is that this plan, as I understand it, is one in which the defendant had a right to get his money out now. But that's not true of many pension plans. Many pension plans are simply a contingent agreement to pay later at a certain age or to pay to dependents if that's so provided. So is your position that in the latter kind of a plan that you have a right to get somehow get access to this contingent money now?
Yes, Your Honor.
How do you do that? Pension plans don't operate that way. There is no value to the in a traditional pension plan, as opposed to a 401k or profit-sharing plan, as my understanding is that there is no set-aside money for any individual, and it's only actuarially available to them, but it's not available to them at this point.
Well, thinking more about Your Honor's question, it may certainly be that pension plans that have the kind of provision that Your Honor has mentioned would decline to pay, and properly so, until the beneficiary becomes actuarially eligible to receive the money.
At which point, if it's actuarially available to entitled to monthly benefits, maybe to a cash out, but maybe not, depending on ERISA and on the particular pension plan. So I don't see how you can get anything more than the individual is entitled to. Is that you agree?
That is true. But in this case, the individual is entitled to the money. And we believe
there's been a lack of clarity about that in your briefs and in some of the opinions, it seems to me, because this is a particular – this is really more of an individual account kind of a plan, but many are not.
Well, in this case, May Department Stores is the operator of the plan, and they have never told us that Mr. Novak is not entitled to the money. To the contrary, we believe Mr. Novak is entitled to the money.
He's also old enough, I guess, to cash out now, but many people are not without a penalty. What would you do with that?
I don't know. I guess that would be the next case to come up.
Did he apply for a cash out or a payout?
No. We applied for a garnishment order.
Now, you said that the only consequence of your position is that the government gets its money now instead of later. But what if it's a pension plan where the person who's been convicted of a crime and is subject to the restitution order dies before the distribution date, and the pension now goes, according to the pension terms, to the surviving spouse?
Well,
at that point, I don't think the restitution order operates against the surviving spouse, does it?
Your Honor, first of all, the government doesn't get the money particularly. The government is simply collecting on behalf of victims of crime. Secondly, Your Honor, there's a provision in the criminal code that says restitution orders are no longer enforceable after the death of the person that's subject to the order.
Yeah, that's the point of my question. That is to say, we're not only talking about waiting, we're talking about whether, because it may very well be that the person subject to the restitution order dies before the distribution date, in which case the money's never going to go to anybody other than the beneficiary under the plan. And Guidry quite clearly talks about the innocent parties who might be the beneficiaries of the plan and the desire of Congress to protect them and the desire, therefore, to make it very explicit in any congressional statement that they intend to get at it.
Certainly, plan beneficiaries could be affected by a garnishment of benefits that are due and payable to the beneficiary.
So your statement that the only consequence of your position is that it's now instead of later, that's not right.
Well, but Mr. Novak has the right to cash out his plan benefits.
But you're arguing for a much broader principle. That is to say, your notwithstanding clause is not restricted to cash out plans.
That is true, Your Honor. We are arguing for that.
Counsel, do we have to overrule Jackson in order for you to prevail?
Your Honor, Jackson was a sentencing case. It came up at the time that the district court was fashioning orders for sentencing, and it's a very different situation than this case. If Jackson is read by this court to mean simply that the district court lacks an equitable power at the time of sentencing to fashion the remedy that the district court did in Jackson, that that's an equitable power that's not available under Guidry, then there's no problem with Jackson. If Jackson is read to mean much more broadly that the United States and a crime victim can never access the money in an ERISA-qualified pension plan, then we believe Jackson is contrary to federal law and should be corrected at this time.
Counsel, the only case that I found from our sister circuits on whether the notwithstanding clause means restitution and fines trump ERISA anti-alienation is Irving from the Second Circuit, and that goes your way. Are there any others that have come down?
Not that I know of on the circuit level, Your Honor. There's a variety of district court and magistrate court decisions that were affirmed by district judges around the country, and they all go.
They go your way, but they're just district court, right?
Yes. But there's
Irving is circuit, and that's the only one?
Yes, Your Honor. And there is no case that we've located that holds that ERISA-qualified pension plans may not be accessed by crime victims pursuant to Section 3613A.
Are there any other – if we were to hold that this notwithstanding language is sufficient, are you aware of any other implications of that, i.e., other statutes that would then be creating exceptions to the ERISA anti-alienation provision, other than the tax statute in this one?
Yes, Your Honor. I am aware of several. For example, in Title VII of Section 1509, there's a provision that says that crop insurance payments are not subject to attachment or garnishment. I presume that crop insurance payments would become subject to attachment or garnishment for a criminal restitution judgment. In Title 45, Section 231M, railroad retirement benefits are, again, not subject to attachment or garnishment.
Isn't there an exception for railroad retirement in the tax code? I think there is one.
I'm not aware of that, Your Honor. But, again, this is an anti-attachment or garnishment statute that would be superseded by federal criminal restitution judgments. The same is true under Title 38, Section 1970G, where payments under the service member's group life insurance are exempt from claims of creditors and are not.
I was actually asking the opposite question, which is whether there are other notwithstanding clauses in other federal statutes that would therefore lead to an exception to the ERISA provision.
I'm not aware of that, Your Honor.
Can I get back to 29 U.S.C. Section 1056? This is the – I want to go back to D4. The order of requirement to pay arises under a judgment of conviction for crime involving such plan. Other than restitution, what might be covered under that section? Are we concerned with fines to the United States?
Yes, Your Honor, because Section 3613A also pertains to fines.
Is there anything else other than fines to the United States?
Special assessments of $200 per count.
Okay. And are there other restitution provisions that might come into play here?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Unless there are other questions, I would conclude and ask to reserve my 10 minutes. Thank you.
Hey, let me ask you this question. I just have this question. Senator McCain, in February of 96, introduced a bill that would have provided that Section 206D of ERISA be amended to state that the anti-alienation provision shall not apply to a qualified criminal restitution order. And that proposed bill did not make it into the final version of the MVRA. Now, doesn't that tell us that Congress considered that question and rejected it? And the Congress specifically rejected the provision that would have applied to qualified criminal restitution orders under ERISA.
Your Honor.
And the alienation provision, of course, wouldn't have blocked that.
Yes, Your Honor. Am I
wrong when I say that?
Your Honor, failed legislative enactments are generally not considered to be conclusive of anything. For example, I note that in the Supreme Court's opinion in Lockhart that Judge Wardlaw referred to a minute ago, the Court noted that it declined to read any meaning into the failed 2004 effort to amend the statute.
Also, wouldn't it matter what the sequence was? When I looked into it, it appeared to me that notwithstanding language was not in there at the time, in December 1995. It only came in conference. So notwithstanding language could have been exactly responsive to this concern.
In this case of INS versus Cardoza-Fonseca, the Supreme Court stated, few principles of statutory construction are more compelling than the proposition that Congress does not intend sub silentio to enact statutory language that it has earlier discarded in favor of other language. So Congress rejected it.
Your Honor, I'm not familiar with the INS case that you referred to, I'm afraid.
Right. Thank you
very much.
Well, here's the citation is 480 U.S., and I'm looking at pages 442 and 443.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. You may reserve the rest of your time. You have about 4 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, my name is Martin Baxt. I'm the attorney and appearing on behalf of Raymond Novak, the appellee. Excuse me. I think we start with Guidry. Actually, we start with ERISA, but we start with Guidry in terms of the analysis. And in Guidry, our Supreme Court tells us that if exceptions are to be made, it's up to Congress, not the courts, to make them. Guidry tells us that the identification of any exception should be left to Congress. And we know from Guidry that a clear directive from Congress is required to abrogate the anti-alienation provisions of ERISA. And I'll get to that in a second. The government contends that the MVRA is actually the result of the Guidry holding and that the MVRA is a specific collection statute. The appellee contends that the MVRA is not specific. It's not a clear directive and falls short of the Guidry directive.
Counsel?
Yes.
I have trouble with the idea that it's not clear. When two statutes say opposite things and one of them says notwithstanding any other statute, that seems to me like a fairly clear directive from Congress that the notwithstanding statute trumps the more general statute. They do that all the time. It's just a common way to write statutes. What's the matter with it?
I think that if we look at the notwithstanding language in the context of Guidry, then what the
Guidry says no equitable remedy. It doesn't really
But the notwithstanding language then basically dissolves the exceptions in two of which were discussed by Mr. Whittlesey. You've got exceptions with respect to ERISA for railroad retirement benefits. You have exception for workers' compensation benefits. You have exception for Medal of Honor winners. You have exception for individuals who the crop insurance. If we read the notwithstanding language, then all of that goes away. In essence,
No, it doesn't, because it's specifically incorporated in one, property exempt from tax levy for taxes. If that's It's an exception to the notwithstanding language.
But the levy for taxes only refers to Federal taxes. It doesn't refer to State taxes. And the Ninth Circuit has held that back in 1990, that State taxes are
There's a substantial question about whether the notwithstanding any other Federal law means that applies to State exemptions as well. That, I think, is true, because the sentence before it says under Federal law or State law. So I don't know whether the notwithstanding language applies to State exemptions, but it certainly seems to apply to Federal exemptions.
But in looking at it, it would appear that it applies to everything, that when you say notwithstanding any Federal law, in essence, what the MVRA is doing is it is basically saying that the exemptions in ERISA fall. The rule in the MVRA swallows the exceptions in ERISA.
Couldn't Congress do that? I mean, Congress could do that if it did so clearly. You concede that,
Congress,
right?
Congress can do that, but according to Guidry, it has to do it by a clear statement.
But why is it that the Supreme Court said that it has to be a clear statement, not because of something unique in ERISA, but because it said in the Guidry case, you didn't have a congressional enactment of any kind on one side that could be argued to be a specific enactment. You had the general notion that Federal labor law somehow ought to permit a constructive trust. A very general against the specific. Is there anything more than that that Guidry's talking about that requires a clear statement?
I don't think that Guidry is talking about anything more than that. I think that when the charge is made to Congress, that Congress needs to do something more than create a general statute. I think
what makes this a general statute? I mean, it does say notwithstanding anything else, and it does make an explicit analogy to what the tax collectors can do.
I believe that Guidry requires a specific articulation of the exceptions that have to fall.
Why?
Because, well, it's my interpretation of what Guidry says. I think that if the MVRA simply said, if you're convicted of a crime, your pension benefits can be taken to satisfy restitution. That's a specific statement. ERISA isn't even mentioned in the MVRA. It's not even mentioned in the history.
It's not only the notwithstanding language. It's notwithstanding, and then there's an affirmative statement. A judgment imposing a fine may be enforced against all property or rights to property. That's the affirmative statement. And that seems quite definite. It says anything. So why isn't anything that isn't accepted?
Well, again, I don't want to keep going back to the concept of a specific articulated statement, but I believe that's what Guidry tells us.
And it also says, including Section 207. 207 is not an exception. It's an including. We know why 207 is in there, which is it specifically requires something expressed. But it's an anti-alienation provision. And doesn't that suggest that anti-alienation provisions in general are included?
I don't believe it can. I think we're dealing with a general statement that swallows up the specific rule.
How is this any more general than the statement in the ERISA? ERISA doesn't make specific reference to the victim predecessor statute or the later statute, either the Witness and Victim Protection Act or the Mandatory Victim Restitution Act. Those aren't referred to in ERISA. It seems to me that calling one specific and the other general kind of misses the point, because neither one refers to the other, and we're left trying to figure out which one trumps. But I don't see anything in the ERISA provision or in Guidry that says that it's more specific than the statute here.
Well, ERISA preceded Guidry initially. It was amended, I believe, in 97, but it preceded Guidry. If Guidry is interpreting ERISA, then I think we need to start with Guidry.
All Guidry says, and I thought we'd established this before, all Guidry says is a very general reference in the Federal labor law used by a court to impose a constructive trust. That's too general. That doesn't trump a specific statute. But it seems to me that the statute we have here is a specific statute, or at least as specific as ERISA is. So why aren't they treated on the same level?
Well, again, my argument goes back to Guidry, and I apologize. I believe that the MVRA, in failing to mention ERISA and in failing to deal with the exceptions that are set forth in ERISA, well, the specific any exceptions that are set forth in ERISA, doesn't meet the Guidry guideline.
Counsel, let's go back to Guidry for a minute. The specific language in it. It is an elementary tenet of statutory construction that where there is no clear intention otherwise, a specific statute will not be controlled or nullified by a general one. We do not believe that congressional intent would be effectuated by reading the LMRDA's general reference to other appropriate relief as overriding an express specific congressional directive that pension benefits not be subject to assignment or alienation. Now, building on what Judge Clifton just asked you, it looks to me as though Congress responded here with a specific statute about which trumps which. And Guidry does not say that there's some super status to the ERISA anti-alienation provision. It's not like abrogation under the 14th Amendment where you need an especially high degree of clarity. It's just two statutes of equal force that might be hard to reconcile if they didn't give you language telling you which trumps which. I have problems seeing how Guidry actually helps you.
I believe it's up to Congress to make the distinction. The courts certainly.
There's a traditional way to do it, which they seem to have done, and that's how the Second Circuit and all the district courts have read it. Is there any sister circuit that's read it your way?
No. There is no sister circuit that has read it my way, but I don't believe there is any sister circuit, including in the Second Circuit in Irving, that has read it the other way. Irving refers to taxes owing to the government. It doesn't refer to restitution.
And that brings me to the question I was going to ask you. Do you agree that under the statute, the restitution order is to be treated the same as if it were an order for the collection of taxes?
I do not, because that doesn't go all the way. It certainly would if it's to be treated the same way as collection of federal taxes. But state taxes.
All right, take federal taxes. You do agree that the restitution order is to be treated the same way as if it were a federal tax order?
That's what the courts have told us.
Well, then what do you do with our case that says that that a federal tax order may be the attachment may be enforced? But do we have to overrule McIntyre?
No, it doesn't say a federal tax order, though. It just says a tax order, and that's where there is an ambiguity, because some tax orders cannot be reached. Well, the pension cannot be reached for restitution of, let's say, for example, state tax.
What about the fact that McIntyre, leaving aside any cross-references, the fact is that McIntyre, or does McIntyre hang on similar notwithstanding language, such that if we don't overrule McIntyre, then we have to accept the fact that this notwithstanding language has the force the government argues for it?
I didn't read McIntyre with the idea that the notwithstanding language controlled with respect to McIntyre, and I apologize, but that was not my reading of McIntyre.
Would you be more precise with that? Because if you look at 3613A, it talks about enforcement, and that's where the notwithstanding language is. It then talks of C about how the judgment is treated as a lien as if it were under the tax laws, which could, in fact, be, if you spread that out, the case law could be enforced against ERISA benefits. What, in your view, is the relationship between A and C?
Uh, I believe that, well, if it is a fund from which we could take the money, again, that I don't believe that meets the criteria of a definite statement.
I have no idea what you just said.
Well,
isn't C just all about, you know, a tax lien is sort of like has super priority.
Federal tax lien.
Federal tax lien does. Isn't C just recognizing that a restitution lien essentially gets priority over all other liens to the same extent as a tax lien?
I think if it does, then we're faced with this social policy argument that what we're doing is putting the rights of, in this particular case, a multinational corporation, but I don't think we need to distinguish between corporations and individuals. We're putting the rights of an individual over the rights of a state taxing authority, which arguably represents all of the citizens of a state.
Well, doesn't it just mean that the lien can be in that the restitution lien or fine lien can be enforced in the manner that a tax lien can be enforced?
Yes, it does.
The procedural aspect.
But procedurally, yes, but not necessarily against an ERISA pension.
Well, that gets back to the question of whether we need to – what do we do with McIntyre? How do you treat McIntyre in this, as Jim Reinhart asked?
I think – well, I don't think that we need to overrule McIntyre. I don't think that –
And how would you square McIntyre with Jackson?
I don't think that McIntyre and Jackson are dealing with the Jackson is dealing specifically with the pension – well, with the cashing out of a pension plan, an immediate payment of a pension plan. McIntyre does not deal with that. So I don't think the two –
I don't understand that. This plan is a plan that, as I understand it, allows an immediate cash out. In other words, it seems to be an individual account plan, and Mr. Novak himself could go and get all that money now. Is that right?
I don't know that to be true. I know that Mr. Novak has not reached retirement age, and I do not know whether he
– About 59 and a half?
I don't believe he is.
But it was 59 at the time of the
He may be. I don't know. I know he's younger than I am.
But he was born in 47.
If he was born in 47.
Well, he's not quite 59.
He's right there.
Okay.
I don't know whether, well, certainly, but for the lien, I don't know whether he could take the money now.
The documents seem to suggest that. They seem to say that he could get the whole – he just has to apply and he could get all the money. I don't know why that is, but it appears to be saying.
If that's the assumption that we make, then perhaps, yes, he could get the money. And if he did take the money, that money would be subject to seizure. The government –
But you were trying to draw a distinction between a cash-out situation and a non-cash-out situation. I'm not understanding it, because this – is a situation where, as I understand it, the money is available for immediate cash in, which is not true of a lot of pensions, but it seems to be true here.
I honestly don't know whether that money is available. Would be, but for this case, I don't know whether the
but
money
is available. But what distinction were you just drawing? You were earlier drawing a distinction with the earlier case, saying it's different because it was a cash out situation.
I don't believe that was my – I don't know.
If I understand your position correctly – then in the type of plan where the employee does have the power to cash out, to take his money, a criminal employee can avoid paying restitution to the victim of his crime by choosing to leave his money in rather than choosing to take it out, right?
Yes. Well, it's not my argument, but it's certainly logical that if that were the case, then an employee would simply leave the money in and avoid having to pay restitution. I agree with that particular concept. I don't know that that's what's happening here, but I think that if that is something that can happen, then it's up to Congress to deal with that in a specific statute.
Why would Congress mean to do that, even when it says, notwithstanding other laws, crime victims come first?
Because I believe that the notwithstanding language is not specific and does not meet, and I realize I've said it before.
But what about the language that comes after the notwithstanding? What about the next language that says that all property and all rights to property are subject to payment? The affirmative phrase in that sentence.
But then that still runs afoul of the anti-alienation provisions in ERISA.
Yeah.
This
is Judge Pragerson. I want to ask you the same question I asked counsel for the government. I mean, were you aware that Senator McCain put in a bill that provided that Section 206D of ERISA be amended to state that the anti-alienation provision shall not apply to a qualified criminal restitution order, and that bill didn't make it into the final version of the act? In other words, that approach was rejected. Are you aware of that?
I am not. Not until
you're not.
It was just mentioned.
So I don't know why that, if we're considering congressional intent, and Congress rejected that provision that would have exempted the that would have allowed a restitution order to be collected on an ERISA plan. That tells us what Congress's intent was. I don't know why we need to go through all this puzzling legislation. You weren't aware of that.
I was not aware.
Senator McCain, you can get it at 142 Congressional Record S1276-07, Daily Edition, February 20, 1996. He put that in, Senator McCain did, and it was turned down. And why that is pretty conclusive as to what Congress's intent was, I don't know. Instead of having to go through all these puzzling approaches that we're taking that are stimulating, but I don't think answer the question.
Counsel, would you agree that a ruling in your client's favor would create a circuit split?
With regard to McIntyre? Well, no, not with
regard. With regard to the Second Circuit.
Irving? No, because I believe Irving deals specifically with taxes and specifically with taxes, with money owing to the government as opposed to a private litigant or a victim in this particular case.
Counsel, may I ask you the following? Assuming that I were to agree with the government that notwithstanding any other federal law is sufficiently specific to take into account the anti-alienation provision of ERISA. Now I'm just trying to figure out, okay, what do they mean? Notwithstanding any other federal law, a judgment imposing a fine may be enforced against all property or rights to property of the person fined. Now, the problem that worries me here is that we've got various kinds of pensions. Some of them are specific to the particular individual who's been convicted of the crime and who is subject to the restitution order. And indeed, within that category, sometimes they can get the money right now if they simply ask for it. Other ERISA pensions, however, are contingent upon various things and indeed may never come to the person who has been convicted of the fine. If, for example, that person predeceases the distribution date under the pension, it may end up going by virtue of the pension agreement to the surviving spouse. Is it possible to read property or rights to property to allow execution as against someone who has an undisputed right to a property, but to protect it if it's a contingent right? I'm trying to figure out if there's some workable way to take into consideration the various factual situations we're going to come into and that the Court references in Guidry in terms of what Congress seems to have had in mind about various innocent people who are potentially beneficiaries of the plan.
Well, I think that the Lazarowitz case attempted to do that because that dealt with restitution in favor of the United States and held that that's to be treated the same as tax liabilities. But in fact, it was as recently cited by the government, the Wright versus Rivland, right out of our circuit, dealt with distributed versus undistributed money. And the Ninth Circuit held that if the money is being distributed or is being assigned, you can take it.
But what about if it is immediately distributable but hasn't been distributed? In other words, I owe you tomorrow $1,000 for the month of such and such.
I understand.
Then I there is some benefit, which is, I assume, why people fight over this, to getting it before rather than after it's transferred, mainly because after it's transferred, it may be harder to trace and so on. So does it matter in terms of, because I had a similar concern or interest, what does right property or right to property mean? It doesn't mean something that's, if it's immediately distributable, is it therefore a right to property, but not if it's only contingently distributable?
I don't believe that, any district has addressed that particular issue as of yet.
But don't we have to have it in mind in order to decide this case, to know what it means to have a right to any property or right to property?
We have to have it in mind if we believe that Congress had it in mind with respect to the MVRA. I think that,
since this is a writ of garnishment, doesn't this depend on how the garnishee defendant answers the writ? It depends on what the garnishee defendant says he or she is holding for the debtor.
Well, assuming what we're doing is determining whether the person has a present right to the money, but just simply refuses not to
do it. Right. If the plan answers that they have no present right to the money, then that's the answer to the writ of garnishment in that case.
I agree with that.
In Guidry, they were trying to get money to which there was a present right, as I understand it. What they were trying to do was go in and get from the – actually, it's an offset is what they were trying to get as the money became due, is my understanding. Not – they weren't trying to accelerate the payment due, but as the money became due, they were trying to get it for themselves.
Yes, I believe in Guidry there was a judgment in favor of the –
There was a judgment, but the nature of the constructive trust, as I understand it, is as the money became due, pay it to us instead of to him, rather than accelerate – what was due.
I believe that's the case.
Do you know if your client can withdraw the money without penalty?
I don't.
So let's assume that he let's play this out for a minute, because I think that may bear on the case. The government exercises his right, garnishes his right to withdraw the money, takes the money. Normally that would be subject to a 10% penalty, and that would be taxed. Is your client responsible for that?
And that's an interesting point, whether an involuntary distribution creates a tax on the initial beneficiary of the plan. I don't know.
Any reason to think the answer would be different than the answer in a tax collection case? If money's taken out of a pension account for tax collection, presumably it has whatever tax impact it has. Would this case be any different?
I don't think it would be different. It's an involuntary distribution. I don't think it would be any different from any tax collection case.
Is there an answer to that question? Because I was wondering about it as well. In the tax cases?
If there is, I don't know the answer.
What ultimately is your response on McIntyre, just to go back to that? I think that we got sidetracked on it. But what possible difference is there between McIntyre and this case? I understand one's about taxes and the other one isn't. But aside from that, conceptually, and the way the statutes are structured, what's the difference?
I think if we exclude the ones about taxes and one isn't, then there is little difference of any.
So how could we – I mean, if the statutes are written in the same way, how could it matter to us whether one's about taxes and one isn't?
Because the – well, again, the issue is who is getting the money. And I believe that there is taxes have always been an exception to the anti-alienation provision. Taxes owing to the government have always been.
Yes, but if they now took the same language they used in taxes and they used it here, doesn't that signal that they want this to be the same thing?
But if they wanted it, they should have said it. I think that's what Guidry tells us.
But they didn't say it with respect to taxes any more than they said it here. They said nothing clearer with regard to taxes. It's at the same level of clarity. Is that true?
Yes.
The May Department's response to the levy doesn't state whether or not the benefits were payable immediately.
That's correct. It does not.
All it says is that they were vested.
Yes.
So does that mean you don't know whether or not he could just apply for benefits now?
I don't believe that the concept of vesting is the same as the concept of the ability to withdraw the money. Pension benefits vest all the time.
Right, but could he apply for the benefits today?
I don't know. My suspicion is that he probably could, but for the lien. But I don't know that, and that's just a suspicion.
Isn't there in the record, there's an answer of garnishee which says that in accordance with the terms of the plan, debtor is entitled to receive distribution of his benefits in the May Department Store and his accounts under the May Department Store's profit sharing plan. To receive payment of benefits, he must complete and submit an application of payment of benefits. I took that to mean that he could get the benefits, subject to these problems about the 10% discount on the taxes, which I'm also curious about. But leaving that aside, it appears that he could simply apply and get the money. Is that what this says here?
Yes, I've read that, and it certainly seems to say that. And again, I don't know about the tax consequences. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to go back for just a minute to the level of clarity of the notwithstanding any other federal law provision. If that provision were found by the courts not to be sufficiently clear to override the ERISA anti-alienation provisions, it would in effect require Congress to put in a laundry list of statutes every time it wants to amend a statute. So Congress would have to say in Section 3613A, notwithstanding ERISA, notwithstanding the crop insurance statute, notwithstanding the veteran.
Well, but no, that's not true. This clear statement rule comes out of Guidry, and it's specifically applicable to ERISA. And we don't know that with respect to the other statutes you're referring to.
If the Court believes that Guidry establishes some other level of clarity for amendment of ERISA than applies to other federal statutes, then I agree with Your Honor. But assuming that
in general, I mean, I don't know, what do you do with the statement that we've repeatedly held that the phrase notwithstanding any other law is not always construed literally? And then we have a whole series of cases in which we don't construe it the way it would seem to be understood by most people. I don't know, when we say we don't always do it, we don't say when we do and when we don't. But certainly it's not unusual to say that that phrase doesn't mean literally what it says, at least in this circuit.
Well, Your Honor, in this circuit, in the McIntyre case, it seems to have meant exactly what it says, and it seems to have applied
others,
to ERISA.
And others it doesn't. And how do we tell when?
I don't have an answer to that, Your Honor.
Let me come back to a different version of Guidry when it's talking about people who may be innocent, who may be beneficiaries of the pension plan. Even if someone has an immediate right to a pension, that is to say, an immediate right to a payout, I think it will often be the case for example, in California, if the work was done in California, community property. But your position is, despite the fact that it's community property, you get all of it?
Yes, Your Honor, I'm glad you brought that up because I meant to discuss it. All enforcement actions that the United States takes on behalf of criminal victims have implications for third parties in virtually every case.
Yes,
the
Supreme Court thinks that Congress and ERISA is trying to pay attention not only to the wage earner, but to all of those who might be beneficiaries under the pension plan, and many of whom are going to be innocent.
Every time, as I mentioned, Your Honor, every time we take an enforcement action, we affect spouses, we affect heirs, we affect all kinds of people who thought that they had a property interest in property that the government is taking. And I don't see any.
But we don't, in most of those cases, we don't have a congressional intent statement that the purpose of that property was to protect not only, in this case, the pension holder, but the beneficiary. So if the government enforces a levy against somebody's automobile or even their house or their business, they don't have the same statutory protection as pension plans, do they?
That is true, Your Honor. However, the crop insurance payment statute, presumably, the veterans disability pension statute, the railroad retirement benefit statute, those are all intended, I would submit, by Congress to benefit not only the actual beneficiary, but also dependents. Thank you very much for your attention.
Argued is submitted for decision, and the court stands adjourned.